This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
It's been very interesting for me. I feel a fraud here, really, because we've had some absolutely fantastic and experienced speakers that have given us some really, really good talks this morning. So I'm very much hoping that you guys are going to help me out this afternoon when we're doing this. I am no expert in this. My background is that I'm a hospital-based paediatrician. I work at Cambridge. I've worked for a number of years, shall we say, on the children's intensive care unit there. I've had no training whatsoever in bereavement counselling or support at any stage, and really it hardly exists. It hardly exists really in medical training at all. But we've had around 25 deaths a year in children over the 20 years that I've been there. So I've dealt with some 500 or so children's deaths in hospital, some of which have been planned and anticipated, some of which have been sudden and unexpected. And we've run a bereavement service there for most of those 20 years that was set up particularly by a fantastic nursing colleague of mine, Penny Cook, who has written and done a lot of work on this and was fantastic with me. So we've done a number of these, and obviously I've got that very, very localised experience, but I don't have experience out in the big wide world. So I'm very much looking for people to come and to join me in this and see what we go. I'm going to open it up in a minute, but I think it's always difficult to start these things cold, so I'm just going to tell a couple of my own anecdotes, if you like, if anecdotes is the right word, I'm not sure it is, stories perhaps. About some of the things that I've been involved with, or some of the more memorable cases, particularly with sudden and unexpected death. And I would just want to raise up a few issues with that. The sort of issues I'll come to the stories, but the issues I was feel that might be interesting to discuss, and I just put them out there for thoughts, are issues about where the child dies, or where I'm involved with children, or where the parent dies when one is dealing with these, whether this is a hospital-based death or whether this is a community-based death. I think there are different issues associated with each of those. The role of culture and religion we've heard a little bit about, but I think that's quite important to think about too, with sudden and unexpected deaths and how that affects it. And possibly an area that I have done a bit more work in, which is the active withdrawal of care in situations where one is making an active decision not to continue care, and how we involve in there, and that might be something that people want to pick on. So I'll just throw those out, but there are plenty of other issues. The two stories involved two very different children at the different ends of the spectrum of my experience. That is a baby and a 15-year-old boy. The 15-year-old boy was a young lad who died in the course of a morning of meningococcal infection. And he'd been perfectly well, come into hospital, feeling a bit unwell at about 9 o'clock in the morning, and by 12 o'clock he'd died. And he died in a pretty unpleasant and horrific manner and had been troubled up. The difficulty and interesting problem with this sudden and unexpected death was that his family were on holiday in Kenya at the time and clearly unable to get back. He was being looked after by friends, and so we had to deal with support for the parents, and at the time that they came back from Kenya, which was some time later. And when Penny and I wrote, not specifically about this case, but generally about bereavement support, and as I say, it's very much for children's deaths, we talked about trying to leave a period of time between when the death occurs and when we meet with the family. So we tend to meet about 3 months after the death rather than immediately. We see people immediately, but the meeting, the process, is generally 3 months later for a variety of reasons. And we met with these parents sometime later. It was a couple of months later. And it was quite clear that it was going to be very difficult because they had no real understanding of what had happened, not only why it had happened, which is understandable, but what had happened. So in that particular situation, what we did was reconstruct it. We started by meeting them at the doors of the hospital and walking into the emergency department, and we got the staff who had looked after this lad to be present there, including the anaesthetist who'd intubated him. We then walked with the anaesthetist down the route that he had taken to the intensive care unit. We had the nurses who'd looked after him, but at each stage what we tried to do was to talk them through both visually by actually physically walking down the corridors and by giving the stories to give them something to build on. And it wasn't anything we'd read about, it just felt the right way to do it, and I wondered whether others had had experience of that. And the second story, I don't want to hog this at all, the second story was about a young baby in whom we withdrew care, Fergus. And Fergus died at about 3-4 weeks of age of a muscle disorder. It's like spinal muscular atrophy, SMA, but it's a rather unusual form of SMA. And we actively withdrew care, and this was 7 years ago now. And we had to do so before we could make a diagnosis. So the mother had to take it on trust from us that we believed we knew what was wrong with him and that it was unsolvable and that it wasn't going to go anywhere. And we did withdraw care. And we were only able to confirm, as we did, the diagnosis 2 or 3 or 4 weeks later after the death. And the story about Fergus is that I've been able to stay in touch with that mum over the last 7 years. I was having coffee with her a week ago. And we're planning to go to, or we are going to Amsterdam this September to talk about withdrawing care to a respiratory meeting there of about 18,000 people. So she's very bravely said that she's going to come along and talk about it. And so trying to work out how one uses that. There's lots of parts of that story. There's bits about withdrawing care that are difficult. There's bits about prolonged contact with families. And I think hospitals are particularly good at prolonged contact with families, and there's bits about using families to teach others about the process and what went well and what went badly. So I'm going to stop there and put that up, and just wondered if people had particular areas that they wanted to talk about and what it is that they want to discuss. Let's throw that open. Is anyone here hospital based? I had a feeling I might be the only one. Okay. So when do you guys get involved? What's the point of which you get?
I think you're right. When we always wait at least 3 months, and we literally put it down to licking the wounds. You know, it's very raw. People might come into the centre and just ask what the service involves, but we'll say, look, we'll go away, come back to us, and it is about 3 months. So I agree wholeheartedly with that. I also, excuse me, agree wholeheartedly with the fact that every family, every child, every death, every loss is different. You know, you can have processes that you put into place, but sometimes you really do have to suck it and say, because it might be inappropriate, you know, for that family. I mean, we've recently had a referral of a mum whose baby died at 4 weeks. She had it full term after following a caesarean, but they're still waiting for the genetics report. And her grief is quite intense because she's got no answers. Mm. She'd like to go ahead and become pregnant again, but she doesn't want to just in case she's carrying this gene. And that's been quite hard. She's very angry as well. She's got a six-year-old child who we've been working with. And that's been a little bit difficult because he's got photographs of the house, but the child never came out of hospital. Mm. So I found that one quite hard. Mm. And then one day, she said the little boy had said to Mum, I don't really need to go to see Sue anymore. So we just sat and nattered about how she was feeling, what support she was getting. And then he turned around and went, but this is my time. You know, so really, in a backward way, he does want the support. You know, well, why are you talking to Mum? This is my time. So, as I say, I think a lot of situations are very much suck it and see.
That's you done.
Yeah. You should have the microphone.
Yeah.
Anybody else?
Just on the reconstruction, that interested me particularly because I went through something like that personally. My mother died when I was a child of 8, and I was very much in that sort of time where children didn't ask questions and children weren't given answers, didn't get to say goodbye, didn't even know there was anything the matter. So for me, this actually happened many years after the event as an adult, that I did need to reconstruct those last days with my mother. And it actually happened through the death of a friend of my son's, and somehow I don't quite know why, but that just triggered off a whole lot of stuff to do with my own mother's death. And I actually wrote to my father, not my father, my brother, and my aunt, because my father had died at this stage, asking them if they would fill in the details for me of those last days with my mother. And that was tremendously helpful. It gave me a story which I needed all that time. I'd been sort of like grieving in a vacuum, not actually knowing the facts. And so I can sort of partly identify with those people having been away, and this has all happened, and how can this be? And I think, strangely, I felt a little of that with this friend that had died, because I'd seen him well, and he'd suddenly died. This is my son's friend. So I think it was sort of in some way mirroring the situation, but perhaps not quite so close and personal to me. So I found that very interesting, and I just feel there is a lot of scope for reenacting in some way, and you obviously found a very appropriate way of doing it.
It was interesting. We made it very visual, and she said very much that it was the visual aspects that helped her. And I did love Julie's comments about it's not necessarily the events, it's how we remember them that matter. And she clearly didn't have anything to remember. So perhaps with sudden and unexpected death, one of the difficulties is that you don't have a framework. You haven't got a sort of narrative there. And was it the narrative for you, or was it the imagery? Was there a physical reconstruction, or was it just a discussion of the process?
It was just a discussion, and it was like hearing what had happened at the end. Apparently my aunt had been with her when she died and had helped turn her over, and she said my aunt had been with my mum when she died, and she said, how is that? And my mother said, it's lovely. And with that, she died. Mm. And so there was a sense of a spiritual aspect as well, that she had seen beyond what was happening. And so for me, that was an immense encouragement. Mm. And just, I felt like, oh, I could have had that all those years ago, had I asked. That was partly my fault. Mm. And partly the culture I grew up in. So for me, it was the imagery, very definitely. It wasn't a physical reenactment, but I had some pictures in my head, which was what I needed.
Can I ask you, how did you know that this is what these parents needed? Have you got a mic?
Well, yes, I have. I got one on. Well, it's almost back to this business of being taught. And we had an interesting discussion. You were at the school's meeting, the meeting around schools. And one of the discussion points in there was around the need for training. And as I said, I've never had any training. And I try to provide training to the junior doctors who I work with. And actually, I find it incredibly difficult. Regularly I'll be going into a meeting. I was at a discussion last weekend with a family who've got a very handicapped child. Mother is absolutely convinced she wants full intensive care and, the intubation and the stuff. And dad has come to the point where he doesn't really want that anymore. And the carers feel that it's probably inappropriate. So there's a whole mess of sort of different positions. And I was going in to talk to mum. And I took in one of the registrars, and she said to me, so what are you going to say? And I said, I haven't got the faintest idea. Because I don't. You don't actually really know what you're going to do before you get there. Now, clearly for this one, we did have to set it up. And I suspect it was Penny who had a huge influence on it. And Penny had spoken to this woman by phone 3 or 4 times. And I suspect she just gathered or sensed that there was a blankness there, that there was a loss of, I don't understand what happened. And this was Penny's response to that, because she was very sensitive that way. Mm. It is very difficult, and I just find the whole business of teaching this to people incredibly difficult, because I think, particularly for sudden unexpected ones, it's got to be done on the hoof, hasn't it?
Mm. I think people are very different, aren't they? And they respond very differently. You know, my sister died 2 years ago, and she had multiple myeloma. So she knew she was going to die. We knew she was going to die. Unfortunately, her son, was working in the States on the Obama campaign. He was doing an internship out there. So we had to ring him and tell him that she'd died. Well, of course, the campaign were very good, and they got him to the airport. He's got a rucksack on. He's 19 years old. And he's also upset at the airport. Well, they arrested him. They thought he was a suicide bomber. And so he got delayed coming back. And so when he finally arrived, I said to him, you know, because I know him very well, you know, let me talk you, I'll take you to the hospital. I don't, he didn't want to know. Now, my remaining siblings, myself, all wanted to know that. We went through that. But he didn't want to do any of that at all. And this is someone I knew very well, but I had misjudged what he would require. You know, and I just think, oh, I'm not perhaps very good at judging who needs what, which is why, you know, I was interested.
Yeah.
If they had got halfway through and said, actually, I don't want to know anymore.
We'd have peeled off. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
But I think when you're sort of dealing with the process of bereavement, we do things that we actually got from Winston's Wish, which is feelings charts. And I would love to do a research paper where anger is one of the emotions we say to the child is normal to feel. And the times they colour in their fists and their feet, you know, so things do evolve that children feel in the same way. And it's a recent bereavement, you know, you say, where do you feel sad? In your head, your heart, all over. And it's always all over, you know. So you've got access to stuff that we've been doing that you can prove and say they do go through a process. There's a beginning, a middle, and an end. And they learn to deal with it. They'll never get over it. You know, this is what people don't understand. It's learning, you know, it's the grief cycle, isn't it? At the beginning, and there's so much little space around you and the grief is so big. But later on, the grief remains the same, but the space is much bigger around you.
The anger's a difficult one, isn't it? We had another family where a boy died fairly suddenly of sepsis. And mother and father, dad said, well, you know, people did what they could, everyone, you know, tried. Mum was very angry. She was very angry with the GP. She'd taken the child to the GP a day before or 2 days before. The GP hadn't picked anything up because I don't know that there was anything to pick up or not. And grandma, I think it was her mother, was a GP's receptionist and was incredibly defensive of the GPs. So we had poor mum who was deeply angry. And a husband saying, oh, for God's sake, give it up. You know, it's gone, it's happened, you can't do anything. Grandma saying, nothing wrong with the GPs. And I was saying to them, look, you've got to let her get through this. She's got to go and complain. She's got to go and talk to the GP. She's got to register this and sort that out. And the GP was absolutely furious with me because I said, look, she's got to come and moan at you because that's the only way she's going to resolve this. So people go through these things at different paces and different speeds, but you know that.
Well, it's just reminded me that I had a child in my year, go back about 15 years ago. She was in year seven, she arrived, and so she was brand new to the school. This was in the September. In the October, her mum came home from school, came home from work. Josie was at home, her dad had gone out, and mum just said, I'm not feeling very well, I'm just going to go to bed. Come up and see me in half an hour, bring me a cup of tea. When Josie brought in what was going on, didn't go. Mum had died of meningitis during that period. Now, Josie was only 11. I certainly didn't know her very well. The children in her class bought her a teddy bear. We went to see her. She came back to school within about 2 weeks and appeared fine, right? She appeared absolutely fine. And Dad seemed to move on. He put away all the photographs of Josie's mum. And I think in my experience, with a lot of dads who are left alone, had got a girlfriend within 6 months and had appeared to move on. Josie was fine, appeared fine in year seven, and she came back to school in year eight and she appeared fine. In year nine, she came in, she appeared fine. The beginning of year 10, she came in, beginning of GCSEs courses, and I found her in the corridor one morning. I just said, Josie, what are you doing? She said, I'm looking for my mum. Now, this was a sudden death, but it had taken her 4 years to even talk. Well, she could talk about her mum, but and it turned out there was a huge amount of guilt. Josie felt that she had killed her mum because she hadn't gone and checked on her. And it took, fortunately, we were able to get hold of some very good bereavement counselling within school. Dad didn't know what to do because Dad was somewhere else. He'd moved on. But it took Josie quite a long time. She did work through it in the end, but it was extraordinary that it took 4 years. And I think colleagues sort of thought, well, how can that be? When it was four years ago, it's a long time ago, surely, you know. But she'd never really confronted any of this at all. I thought, to me, it was a hugely important lesson, really.
Just picking up on that point, I think one of the things for young people, and particularly that age group,
are the unspeakables and the laws. So if I feel I have actually killed my mum, where do I actually go to say it? And if Dad's getting on with his own life, I think young people become totally silenced in it, you know? And I know I work with bereavement in Ireland in community settings, you know, not actually through hospitals at all. And very often dealing with sudden and unexpected deaths. And one situation that's come up about a fortnight ago would be three young men who, actually three 15-year-olds, whose friend was swimming with them and drowned in an accident where he was pulled down into a whirlpool. And I literally got a call 15 minutes after the event from one of the dads who was a professional that I knew. What are we going to do? Where are we going to go? Will you talk to them tomorrow? And I actually went, and I did chat to the lads the following day. And I think the key that we don't use often enough is, you know, the common sense of, well, what are your needs? Mm. What do you need of your parents? What do you need of your sports clubs? What do you need of your schools? Mm. Just basics of what you need. What do you need of me? And it was fascinating because it allowed a space to flag up what was going to happen in the following week, you know, where the media were going to suddenly get hands on your story and reassuring them that they knew the truth while media and others may be actually telling a lot of lies about the offence, you know. So I think common sense in that. And again, last week meeting them after the funeral, not starting counselling or anything else, because I believe they need to build their own resilience, but actually meeting them last week to turn around and sort of say, well, what do you need now? And do you need me here? Oh, it's great to find a place where somebody can actually guide us at the moment, and we need that. But it was very much that they would be together. The first day I met them, they were playing snooker with me. You know, it's interesting when Julie was saying it's hard to engage with that age group, but we played snooker at a snooker table. And then they were on Facebook. And I was saying, well, what are the postings like, guys? And what was fascinating was there were uncles and aunts and adults in their lives all putting postings on their website, supporting them. And that meant more to them than anything else. So, you know, I think sometimes it's about let's get into their world as teenagers. And I think teenagers scare us, really, to be honest with you. That's often why we can't meet them in the loss, you know. But being led by them very, very much.
How do you keep the door open? Do you give contact details for them to get back to you, or do you make contact with them?
What actually happened was they've got my number and I've got their number, mobile numbers, and I said, would you like me to text you by the end of next week just to see what's happening in your world? Yeah, do that please, and I'll text you back.
Is that how other people?
That's their world, you know. Their world is text messaging now, so we need to get into it. And it's just, you know, maybe a key point that they've brought up, as each individual did, and just asking them about that. You know, how's the tummy ache that you've had last week? Has it eased? You know, what's happening with exam work? You know, because one of these guys is actually facing into exams, so it's trying to keep him in a position that he can get his head down.
It's quite difficult to do with a caseload, for example, isn't it, though?
Yeah.
So do other people do that? Do other people leave contact, leave open access contact?
Not as a teacher.
Not as a teacher?
Not as a mobile, not a mobile phone.
I work with primary school children, and I always have it open that the tool I use the most, I have to say, is Winston's Wish, Muddles, Puddles and Sunshine, and that takes a long time to do. And even when we finished, it can happen that the child can have a wobble, which is expected, and they've always known that they can come back to it. It's never ended, because that's the way they grieve. It's not, like somebody said, you know, you don't get over it, you learn to live with it, but sometimes when they have a wobble, they know that I'm always there and I'm contactable through the schools. And I had so much empathy with what you were saying. Even though I work with the smallies, it's still the little things you want to talk about. You say, I can't make what's happened gone away, but how can I make it better and what can I do? Yeah. Sometimes it's really simple. I say, can we go out on the field rather than be sitting in our room where we meet? Can we go out on the field, please? Or can we do this, please? Yeah,
But it's difficult for teachers, isn't it? It's difficult to be open.
It's time, isn't it?
It's time.
Well, the teachers, they refer to me.
About 15 years ago, we had a child who, he was a naughty boy and ran with the crowd. And it wasn't so much of gang warfare as children who fell out at school. And there was a shed in the community on an allotment. And two of the boys went into the shed and made a fire. And then they sent Liam in to put that fire out, and they locked the door on him. And all the firemen found were the bones and bits in the corner of the shed. The whole community went into meltdown. And the only thing that we could do as a school was let all the children know. And I mean, at the time, there were 1,700 pupils in that school. And because this child had come from that community, it hit everybody. And it was so tragic and so devastating for everybody. But the children wanted to come into school to be together, and we gave them that time that they needed. And it was just, they supported each other in it. And that was really, really important. Everything just had to stop because it was so dreadful.
How old were the children?
The young man was 11. But, I mean, he'd got sisters and brothers in the school, cousins. Obviously, he was well known. He was a little monkey, but he was a lovely kid as well. It was absolutely tragic. So I think that the most important thing with sudden death like that or tragic accidents is time.
I'd have to agree. I mean, I work in a traumatic bereavement service with David, and when something so unexpected happens, we almost expect that it should have kind of an unusual response. So it feels like we should be able to respond to it in a different way. And actually what children need and children and family need is a whole lot of normal. Mm. And so what you're talking about, the fact that, you know, routine is really important, and those children come into school and having their normality and having their routine is probably the most important thing for them. Mm. And what you were talking about, the community response, and I think communities have a massive amount of resources within them. Mm. And I think, you know, the tendency is to call on professionals or experts to come and deliver some kind of, you know, response, that an expert response. And actually what might be needed is kind of guidance to deliver a normal response, because, you know, professionals can leave, but actually you're left with the community. So
that's right. And the big thing that came from that, a few months later, the children decided that they were going to make a garden for Liam on the allotment. The shed was jiggered, so they got rid of the shed. But yeah,
we make our leave.
Lovely to
meet you. Nice to see you soon. Yeah. Just coming back to resources, because I think one of the things, I guess, that we should try to do, as has been said earlier today, we're preaching to the converted or singing to the choir or whatever else here, because this is a group of people who've chosen to come here and spend time here. It might be helpful to just try and think about the resources. There are a lot of resources in... Yeah. You can't go... Oh, what a shame. I think you've got to go at that end.
Right,
yeah. On film, please note, yeah. Just wave at the camera as you go past. it's start to say, well, you know, we can't all be there for all these situations. We have to train people. What sort of resources should we be trying to make available for these people? Is it the stuff that's out there with Winston's Wishes or Cruise or whoever else it might be who've already got resources? Or should we be providing a basic training? We were talking in schools this morning. What sort of training should we be providing? Is it like child protection, where you've got level one, level two, level three, you know?
I think you come from Winston's Wish, the child bereavement. I've attended three sessions with them, and I think if it could be facilitated to everybody so that everyone has a designated person within school. We have a child protection officer. If we believe a child's in danger, we go straight to them. We have a special educational needs coordinator. So there should be somebody in school. I mean, as a family support worker, I was lucky enough to access the training, so that's me and the schools I work in, but a lot of schools haven't. But I believe that's the way forward, to have somebody that you'd go to that would be trained in each school.
And then we'll pass the training on.
Yes.
Yes, because that's what I could do, facilitate. Yeah. I attended your course in order to facilitate, to do inset days.
Exactly. I mean, the other thing that we say, I mean, we get lots of phone calls from schools, but from many organisations, but with regards to schools, what the norm is that they're asking us for help, but actually when we say, well, you know, what have you got planned? Have you thought of anything? I mean, 9 out of 10 times, they've already got all the answers. Mm-hmm. And they just need that little bit of reassurance that what they're aiming to do is you know, is the right thing. We might actually offer them other options and other suggestions, but actually, you know, they really know what they're doing. And we always say to anybody that comes on our training, I mean, we train around 5,000 professionals a year right across the board, not just schools, doctors, paediatricians, social workers, the whole lot. But we always say, you know, please go back to your workplace and disseminate the information that you're getting here. Make sure that you talk to your colleagues about what you've learned so that, you know, it's not only you know about it, but everybody's aware of it. Because not everybody's going to be an expert, but it's an awareness of, you know, what children within the families need or what adults need to help parent their child when they're going through the process, and how, you know, what professions like you can help to give parents and children informed choices, really, because that's what, you know, that's what they need.
I think that's absolutely right. Is that
one? I think it's recording back there.
And at Winston's Wish, we offer support to professionals that are supporting bereaved families through our helpline. But I'm surprised today that even in this context, people don't realise that. Mm. And I think it comes back to the signposting comments that were made earlier about people working in the field and professionals knowing who to go to
for whatever assistance that's needed. And each particular context might be better directed. Mm. You know, as I was listening in on the helpline at Winston's Wish yesterday, and our family practitioner directed somebody to Child Bereavement Charity because the particular person she was speaking to
is based in an area that
they serve through one-to-one support. So it's about finding the right place for people to go, because I think there are lots of resources out there, but it can be difficult to know which is the best resource for that case and how to access it.
And the wrong time to come up with that is when something's happened. You need to know in advance, well in advance.
I just wanted to say, really, that I'm a community worker and I've got sort of quite a few years of experience of working with families. And I work obviously with people in house that look after the children.
And I just think there's certain people that are more comfortable than others dealing with bereavement. And I think experience is probably the best. I mean, I can sit with a family and I can say, you know, I've got no counselling experience, but I've been in this situation lots of times. And that's, then, you know, they feel confident with that, I think, that there'll be somebody that's sort of been there with other families. So I think it's not something that can be taught, really. It's either something you want to go into or you don't.
But maybe the training's about access. I mean, we've talked about the contact with other people. I mean, one needs people at school. I have a feeling that perhaps the child protection officer and the person who does this are not that dissimilar in a sense. I think the jobs overlap an awful lot. But it's that person at the school, if it's the school, needs to know about the various resources that are professionally available, so that if you're sat and supporting people, that's wonderful, but as long as you know about what the resources out there can be. So it's that linkage, and we've talked about linkage a lot today.
Yeah, I think it is about networking, and we do get lots of phone calls, like from schools as well, so we can, you know, tap into that as well. But I think people, as you say, the schools are looking for answers, but they've already got the assembly sorted, they've already got the memorial day, and so that you know, we all think in the same ways, I think.
I would agree with that, because our deputy head is a child protection officer. He's also in charge of pastoral. And we had a child last year who committed suicide. She was in year 11. The parents had rung the school very early in the morning, and the senior management team, because they are aware and because they we have a bereavement policy, had already rung the hospice and said, just, this is what we're intending to do, could you just give us some guidelines? So it's the fact that they knew there were resources out there, they could contact them, and in fact, just the class were told they were withdrawn for a little bit of time, and then the asked what they'd like to do, and the entire class, including 50% of them who are non-white, decided to all go to church together at lunchtime and light candles. Now, that partly came as a result of getting some advice from local hospice, but it's about education, and it's about bringing it into the fore, as you say, making sure there's resources, but it tends to still fall on the same staff, because, as you say, they're more comfortable dealing with it. And if people are not comfortable dealing with it, I think they can do more harm than good, really.
We're fairly predominantly white Anglo-Saxon, actually female group. So what about ethical and cultural difficulties? I certainly have a wide range of different cultures and religions that I have to deal with, all sorts. Do people struggle with that? Do you think that we're a little bit non-diverse ourselves in terms of the expertise?
Well, I obviously teach in a school which is very diverse in its ethnic makeup. Last year, I took a phone call from a parent. It was about 8:30 in the morning, and normally not that time, like at school. It's a bit chaotic, so it's going on. So, and the officer said, oh, this parent's on the phone, and a girl in my year, and the mother just said, just ringing to tell you she won't be in school today. So I said, oh, that's fine. We need to take the phone call. And I said, oh, is she, what's the matter with her? She's not very well. No, my husband's just died. Literally about an hour, I think. Now, this was a Chinese family. And she said, I must apologise, she won't be in school. She will, of course, be in tomorrow, and she will have a letter. Now, this is within an hour of the death of the father. When the two girls came back to school, we said to them, anything you'd like, if you want to talk, anything, you just say, we never heard another word about it. Nothing. But you have to accept that that is how their culture does things. But it was very strange.
I work in central London, and I go to...
So I go into many houses with different cultural backgrounds. And the first thing I ask, because I meet the parents and the children together to begin with, or perhaps just the parents on their own, to tell them about my role and what sort of things I'd be doing. But I always ask, what are your beliefs and what should I do? What things aren't I allowed to do? I find that a very important one. But I admit ignorance. With cultures I know nothing about, I think children quite like it when you say, I know nothing, tell me, how does your culture deal with this? Because it's like making that story again as well, and finding it so important that you can make your own story about the death. And it's almost a way in, me saying, I'm very ignorant about this, tell me everything, is their way into making a story. So I don't struggle with it anymore. I used to think, oh, how am I going to do it? But now I just think, well, as long as I'm honest, then... So, I think that's how I deal with it. Yeah.
I teach quite a lot of Jewish girls, and we've had some parental deaths of... obviously some of the Jewish girls, and this particular father had dropped dead, and the girl was, I don't know, about 15 anyway, so she'd gone off to the funeral. Obviously they bury their dead very quickly, and the Jewish community have this thing called a Shevra Kedisha, which you probably know about, which it's like a bereavement committee. They deal with everything, and then they have a annual sort of anniversary, and it goes on. And the Jewish grandmother just said to me, she said, oh, bloody Jews, they do death to death. And I thought it was great, because it was way over the top, but only she could say that. But I thought it was quite interesting.
That's good. I mean, we do have cultural difficulties. Certainly I found that there have been some cultural moments, but I was just thinking through as you were talking there, and the issues are much more about decisions to withdraw or withhold care than they are actually following the death. At least that's when I come into conflict. So we have a number of issues, and it can be religious. It can be the religious leader who hasn't been involved with the care but has very strong views about yay or nay or what's it going on. It can be granddad who's sometimes out in the West Indies or, India or Birmingham or a long way away, and can't get to where you are. But I think they're more about withholding and withdrawing and decision-making than they are necessarily about bereavement. I think, as you say, if you go into a home and you make it clear that you're open to suggestions and thoughts, then that's much, much easier.
How you deal with situations with post-mortem when it's necessary, and particularly with the different cultures, when obviously there's parents and communicating the necessity for it, and how you go about doing that?
I'm going to grab that. I'm not absolutely sure this is working, so I'll grab that as well. I think I've killed it. It's in a sense, it's slightly easier than it was. When I
started, there was a great push from doctors to get postmortems in as many cases as one possibly could, the argument being that one sometimes learnt things one didn't expect and it was a process learning. I think it, certainly historically that's been the way we learnt about disease was through postmortems. So there was a culture of saying we would like a postmortem in most situations, and that meant that one then approached families after death and asked for a postmortem. One tried to do it pretty routinely. I think that's becoming less and less so, partly accelerated, though not entirely so, by things like the Alder Hey disaster, which have made life much more difficult. So nowadays, we rarely do postmortems unless it's a coroner's case, and in a coroner's case, I'm legally obliged to. So in a sense, that's not a terribly difficult one. I think the difficult issues are around organ donation, which clearly we want to try and do as much as we can. That's a much more difficult discussion. But post-mortem on the whole isn't too bad. We do occasionally ask we get variable responses. I don't find that too tricky.
I wonder if there's a danger. with us all being Anglo-white, that we might ignore some children, think, oh, it's a cultural thing, we have to let them grieve the way they want to grieve. Isn't that how Victoria Columbia got missed? Everybody said, oh, it's a cultural thing, this is how African families are. And that little girl ended up not getting the professional support she needed.
Well, it was a taxi driver that took the decision, wasn't it, to say, no, I'm not taking you, I'm taking you to the hospital instead.
But I do think there's a danger that we are over-politically correct, we're oversensitive, and perhaps it could be that there is children that will miss out on the support that they need. Because we, in our little worlds, are assuming that their culture, their community, will support them.
Like the Chinese girls who never reappeared again, who knows what's going on. You can't force it.
And all likelihood is those children were getting exactly the support they needed and the community did help them. But I think it's a big assumption we make. Is there a large enough community? Are they there to support them? Mm. Especially around suicide deaths, I'm not convinced.
Yes.
And maybe that needs checking then. It's about, Judith, you were talking about training in schools. It's about people sharing protocols and best practice and going back to check again, because even though they're of an age where they may very easily come to you to ask for help if they feel that they're able to, there will be many more people, regardless of their age or level of maturity, that won't ask for that help, because there's a whole host of reasons why.
Certain types of death. We have a little boy who's a Muslim boy whose mummy was brought into England to Britain to marry and was really, really suffering from depression, finding it very difficult. And the husband had said to her, you must stop beating the child. In England, you mustn't do that. And they were in the lift, 20 floors of a tower block, coming down to school, and he randomly pressed some buttons in the lift, he was four, that he shouldn't have pressed. And she shouted at him and shook him, and she looked up and saw the CCTV camera. She went back up to a flat with him with her and jumped out of 20 floors up in a tower block window. But that's a Muslim family, mental health issues. We're not going to talk about mental health. We don't have mental health. No. We stopped back to Pakistan. He's now back in school with us 3 years later. Hasn't been in school for those 3 years. Never knew mummy. Never been mentioned again. Now, who am I to say that child had the support that they need?
I do find it's difficult.
I'm going to pass this over because I know they're keen to record this.
Quite a large Muslim community that I work with. And I find it's very difficult because there's often a big difference between, there's quite a lot of marriages that have taken place from Pakistan and usually it's the men that come from Pakistan in my experience. And you've got, very well-educated, westernised Muslim mums. And the burying within 24 hours can be very, very difficult and very traumatic because they do know we've got the facilities at Acorns. I've often seen them. But they can't really use them because they can't say goodbye at their pace. It has to all be done so quickly. And then there's also this, not all Muslim families, I do see some of the mums at the hospice away from the family setting, but there is also this belief that that you have to sort of not get over it, but move on straight away and not bring the sadness back into the house. So we've got quite a few muscular dystrophy boys where a brother's died, but I'm not allowed to go back into the house and be sad and talk to the brother. And I do try and sort of talk to them when they're at the hospice. But so culturally it is very difficult because you do want to respect cultures, but you also want to be aware that, how that child's progressing or how that mum is. And it's always that, it's a very difficult situation, really, and I don't know what the answer is to it, really.
Well, we need more Muslim working with children, don't we? We need more. Do we need to try somehow to open the profession up so that there's more representatives from different?
Yeah, we have. We do have. We do have a Muslim community worker. Yes. I don't think she would find that she'd be able to go into the home and do the bereavement work either.
Okay.
No matter, you know, she's the same culture, but that's not their. You know, that's not that. You know, some families, that's not what they believe, really, or one partner doesn't believe. So it's just, I don't really know what the answer is to that, really.
I want to draw back to what I see as a little lacuna appearing in all this, and we've talked a lot about support and a sort of baseline level of knowledge linking into the various professional organisations and professional groups there. But what was picked out earlier was that whilst we've sort of moved to the feeling that schools are a very good site for this, as it were, screening, in other words, this picking things up, because it's a universal area where children will be seen and can be supported and so forth, it was picked up that the children whose parents die, it's not necessarily picked up quite so well. Children who die, support for siblings and support for friends is quite good. Teachers who die, we talked a little bit about this morning, but children whose parents die and where it's separate from the school, it can be quite difficult to pick that information up. How do you think we should ensure that access is available to the Chinese girls? Again, I'm sure that things were done absolutely fine for them, but how do we make resources available if it's not brought to the school? Where do we do that?
I think it's very difficult if it's not brought to the school, because if parents don't want to engage in the process and so therefore won't be part of the taking them, that's it.
Yeah.
And I often argue this at meetings, we can't come to you. No, we have. No, you need to come to us. We're here, we'll give you a room, we'll stay open late if it needs to be a late evening, but you need to come and do it. And often the children will say that, or they don't want mum to see them upset. They don't want mum to have to be part of taking them as grieving, because mum is trying to move on. They want, but they still feel they need it.
So how can we address that?
Why do we need to? Why can't we just people come into school? Why can't we have outreach?
Because whether they come to the resources or not will depend on the parents and not on the child.
Mm. But if it's in school, then the child is there anyway, so the parents don't really need to get involved. They have to give us permission. But beyond that...
But with the work I always do a home visit. Whatever the nature of the work, whether it's a bereaved child or anger management or self-esteem, I always... Oh, sorry, do you want me to...
No,
I'm
sorry.
I do a home visit, and then I get a picture of the whole home life, and that's not just for bereavement; it's for everything. Just so that I get a picture, and then.
So, if they have a parent who dies, you would do that.
Yes, if they wanted me to, I would offer to go in, and absolutely.
Because if they don't,
then I can't do anything about that. If they refuse me, no.
That's my worry, I suppose. Yeah. I think there's a. It's the Swiss cheese theory. There's holes that can appear in a straight line here.
Absolutely. And
people falling through the gaps.
Yes, and I have mummies who tell me she's fine. She doesn't want to talk about it. I've asked her if she wants to talk about it. And she says she doesn't, so just leave her alone. What's the point of raking it over? She's fine. She's over it now.
Yeah.
And all I can say is, in my professional experience, and I've been working for many, many years, I can tell you that in a year's time, or 2 years' time, or 3 years' time, her life has been built on wobbly foundations. If she hasn't addressed this, and I can do no more than that. Mm-hmm. And if mummy still says no.
Mm. Yep.
I don't know how old a child is before it can refer itself. Mm. How old it's deemed to need to
feel. Yes, I don't know.
Can I ask you, do you have you come into, we've had issues with sudden death or withdrawal of treatment from Jehovah's Witnesses?
I had one lovely story. Am I coming over? I think I am coming over. I had one lovely story of Jehovah's Witnesses early in my career. I have dealt with a number of Jehovah's Witnesses, and we had a child who had rhesus disease of the newborn. So the child had reacted to maternal antibodies and had, was terribly poorly and needed blood transfusion, basically, after birth. And... the parents were both Jehovah's Witnesses, and there was a bit of a standoff. And my boss at the time, an absolute role model for me for the rest of my life, Neil McIntosh, an absolute wonderful neonatologist, arranged to bring he's not an imam or a leader, I forget what they're called, the senior member of the church in. And The deal was that, of course, the trouble with Jehovah's Witnesses, if we give blood, then the child is tainted in the parents' eyes, and the parents can then no longer look after the child, and that's a real problem because they sometimes absolutely refuse to take the child. So the deal we struck with this was that Neil would give the blood against the parents' wishes, and he would be cursed by the leader of the church, and that was okay. So he gave the blood. The parents said, no, 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 you mustn't do that. The church leader came and cursed him, and he was forever cursed, but we got the child to survive, and everyone was happy, and all was okay. So that was, you know, and they could accept that. So there are ways around it which are slightly devious. But yeah, we have had dealings with a lot of difficult situations. I mean, I've finished in the High Court on more than one occasion discussing. It's a last resort that one finishes up with the courts in terms of making decisions. And I think it's interesting to me that out of the 25 deaths a year we have in the intensive care units, we probably have no more than one or two that die with resuscitation going on. The rest are planned in some way. So 23 deaths out of 25 a year will be accepted at the end, will be planned withdrawals, done with family present and all the rest of it. So it's quite unusual for a child to die with the full paraphernalia of the medical profession bouncing up and down on top of them. It's sadly not like... And our results aren't quite as good, I have to say. Oh, that's okay, then it's all better. Yes, yeah. No, it isn't. So it is. I think it's those decisions that are often the most difficult. And it may take, you know, in difficult cases, I'd expect to take 10 days or 2 weeks to come to that decision with parents. You know, that's fine. Time is not an issue usually. So with the family I was speaking to this last weekend, I haven't changed Mum's mind yet, but I've just sown a few seeds about what the decision-making process might involve and what criteria she might deem to be worthy of it. And we'll come back to it, and in a week or two's time, we'll get there. And at that stage, we'll be ready. I think one has to accept that there can be a lot of time involved in these things.
Mm. I did wonder about that earlier, actually, when I think it was the first speaker was talking about people dying where they want to die.
Yeah.
And we can go through a personal experience with a godchild of mine who will eventually die. And she was in crisis this time last year. She was about to die. Now she's back at school riding a bike. She's always been a stroppy girl. But they were very, very, very hot on everyone should die at home if they can. But her mother was utterly, utterly certain that if she died in her bedroom at home, that would be the last time her mother would be able to go back into that house again. She said, I can't come down my stairs past my baby's bedroom knowing I don't want... And at some point, I did say to her, because I was living in the hospital with her at the time, I did say to somebody there, at what point do you stop thinking that Zoe is the important person if she's going to die? What about the rest of us that have to carry on living without her? At some point, doesn't what we need and our last memories of her and not being frightened and sitting by her bed with no nurse there thinking, oh, is she going to wake up? What, at what point do we become more important? And I think that's quite...
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Alan Craft talked about 60% of people wanting to die in home and 60% actually dying in hospital.
How many of those people, I wonder, the partners are saying, I don't think I
exactly.
want my
yeah.
husband
I think,
or my child to die in my bed. Thank you very much. I'm going to carry on my life after this.
Yeah. It's a difficult balance. I think it works both ways. I think that's absolutely valid point. I think it is also true that parents who say, no, I couldn't bear it in my house, I need to have people around me, later on regret.
Yes. We change our mind a lot.
So there is a lot of changing of minds going on. I think one just has to accept that. And I think there's, from my point of view, there's two or three elements to it. One is actually intensive care deaths as opposed to ward deaths. I think there's a huge difference there.
We were living in this most beautiful hospice with
exactly.
the doors open to a dump yes. pond. We were so relaxed, yeah. like living in Centre Parks.
Yeah.
So, well, of course we'd rather be there with a little yeah. buzzer by our bedding cage, which we never used the yeah. whole time we were there.
Yeah.
But we knew it was there if we needed to. I suppose, yes. If had she been lying in intensive care, then we probably would have to get out of it. Which is horrible.
Yeah.
I think the thing is about having the choice, isn't it?
Yes.
Mm. But whose choice is it? My
yes. Mm. Balance of choices. Yeah, balance. Consensus.
At what point does it stop being the person who's about to die's choice, and does it become the people who've got to survive that person?
We're going to have to close it down. We've come to our time. Can I thank everybody for joining in? That was fantastic. Great fun. A super day. Well done, everybody. And let's go away and work out how to make it better. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.